Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. Today I'm speaking with Francesca Albrezzi, PhD. She works in digital humanities at UCLA's Office of Advanced Research Computing. I'd like to thank all the supporters who helped make this show possible. If you'd like to help us continue to create this great content, visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways you can support us. So, Francesca, the last time that we did a podcast together, a lot of things have happened since then. We haven't done a podcast in years. So I think at the time you were still working on your doctorate. Now you are, you know, a PhD, and you're, I think, now at UCLA. And you're working, at the time you were working in digital humanities concerning preserving cultural experiences and artifacts and things using a variety of 3D and XR technologies. Since the last time that we talked, like, how has your role evolved? What are you up to at UCLA specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot changed when you finally finished that dissertation. It feels like the weight of the world off your shoulders. So that was a really great moment. And it's also a great coming together of a lot of things you've been thinking about for many, many years. So I think I have a lot more clarity now in terms of the direction of my research. So I look at XR technology in museums and cultural heritage spaces. And the dissertation really looked at modes of publication, display, and information capture. And so now at UCLA, I'm in the Office of Advanced Research Computing as a digital research consultant. So I support other researchers across campus, faculty, graduate students, and we basically support whatever digital methods people are using in their research. My expertise being in 3D and extended reality, but also from digital humanities, different kinds of data viz technology that's out there, mapping, timelines, all that sort of thing. And also just thinking of digital publication as an alternative to print publication.
Hmm. We did a XR day at UCLA a couple of weeks ago. And after we did the main like virtual panels and stuff like that, there was like this really cool, you know, picnic with some people that had watched the thing virtually on campus, and we all got together and we were having a discussion. And one thing that came up that really, you know, kind of excited me was this idea of like philosophically, what is, you know, cultural preservation, right? And we were talking, I think, about how UCLA has an archive of some old digital models of the campus and, you know, architectural type of models, which are much more clear in the way that they present information about the structures, right? So they're very much like planning documents. So, you know, you can almost look at them as a guide for how things are laid out electrically and plumbing and, you know, the, you know, structural stability, things like that. But now there's like this other layer where people are scanning objects on campus, and those are becoming like more capturing the aesthetic qualities, like the current state of how somebody would experience those spaces. Now, both of those represent two very different types of sets of data. And, you know, really they don't compete with each other. They just enhance our ability to understand what the objects or experiences that we're capturing are, right? So it's like, it's more additive to the cultural record. Do you think that, you know, that's the direction that we have to start looking at when we're thinking about how extended reality and especially, you know, capturing spaces and people and things of that nature is going to become important to the overall sociological and archaeological record of who we are?
Yeah. So why I got interested in this to begin with is that I worked in exhibitions. Museums are cultural authorities within our societies, and they have political, social implications and cultural implications in the work that they do. And it's a visual language, but it still makes an argument. And I think for many, many years, there was a thought that museums were apolitical. And that's just really not the case. And so I think we know now that politics are embedded within all of our cultural institutions and our cultural collecting and the way that we build archives. And things like symbolic annihilation are really, really serious. And so we can't be as ignorant of the fact that there are power dynamics that go into how we create an archive, how we create a cultural record. And so that's what I think these kinds of technologies can really shift. We're seeing a lot of community archiving cropping up all over the place and helping to support these sort of main institutional archives, sharing different kinds of stories and documenting different cultures from their own perspectives, from sort of, we talk about edic and emic perspectives, an insider perspective versus an outsider perspective. And I think it's really important to make sure that we have sort of buy-in from the people that are represented within the archive or the collection, that they are participatory within that sort of collection making process. So these technologies, if everyone now has a LiDAR, or many people have LiDAR now in their phones, and they can start to document their own lives in these ways, their cultural artifacts in these ways, without having to give them up necessarily to an organization or a cultural institution, but that they can share them, share the stories related to them, create that metadata, and build out the archive that way, that's a really powerful shift in how we preserve our culture for future generations and share our culture for future generations. And so for me, when you talk about things like, you know, building information models, right, BIMs, this idea of, okay, there's the plumbing and the engineering sort of part of things, and all of these things are annotated in specific ways, and marrying that with these sort of artistic or aesthetic captures that are done by individuals that maybe relate to certain stories, have a particular context, and bringing that context into play, that's a big shift. That's a paradigm shift for the field. And I think that's where we're headed. The main question that I think a lot of libraries, museums, cultural heritage institutions are having is that data is not small. It's big data. It takes a lot of storage space, and that requires a lot of servers. It requires a lot of technical expertise, and that requires a lot of funding. So moving forward, I think we're still on the sort of trajectory to this methodology, but I don't think we have the sort of practical kinks figured out quite yet around how to preserve that much data moving forward.
I hadn't even thought of that. That's a whole new digital divide that is not, you know, probably talked about very much outside of academic circles. And it's incredibly important. So back in 2006, 2007, I'm trying to remember, I was doing a project with History Channel and this museum in New York called Museum of Chinese in America. And recently, when I say recently, I mean like just before COVID, maybe like late 2018, early 2019, something like that, the museum had a terrible fire and their whole archive was, I don't want to say everything was gone, but everything was certainly touched by the fire, right? So what concerns me about that is, like, it wouldn't have been such a tragic loss if all of these, you know, organizing pamphlets, photographs, you know, all these records had been in a digital form. But, you know, as we start thinking about 3D scans, we start thinking about, you know, all these other, you know, types of objects, and there's some FBX objects for people who are listening who don't know what that is. That's just a, like a file format for 3D, you know, objects, same as like an OBJ and stuff like that. Those things can be hundreds of megs just by themselves for a small, simple object. So now when you start, you know, compounding that, that becomes a very, very big financial burden to, you know, not only get the initial storage, but also to keep that storage running, because, you know, hey, you have to power that storage. If you're storing it on the cloud, that's going to be an ongoing expense. And these institutions are already sort of cash strapped. So how do you see that playing out? Are there initiatives right now to try to get discounted cloud data storage, redundancy, stuff like that for these institutions?
Yeah. So the I think what's really interesting about this is that it's also the migration forward. So it's not just the preserving of the current file structure, but also how do you migrate that forward as these technologies change, these technologies keep changing. One of the things you probably know really well, Decker, is that, you know, the technology around 3D material is that cycle is quite, it seems to get shorter and shorter. And so migrating these things forward takes time, cost, energy. And I know to some degree that libraries are having these conversations and they're saying, well, we can guarantee that we can store video, high TIFF images, and that sort of thing. And then anything else is sort of gravy and we just see what we can do. And then if it becomes something we can't support down the line, well, maybe the Internet Archive can take it on. Maybe there's another organization that can take it on, but that we will just try to focus on the things that we know are stable. And so there's organizations like IIIF, the International Interoperability, there's one more I, International Interoperability Image Framework. There we go. And that organization really started this conversation around images themselves. And now they're looking at 3D objects and thinking about how the same type of support that we're going to need or that we needed for images to make sure that we could create collections now with images and share images online for most museums, make those collections available, make that metadata available, all of that sort of standardizing of data really happened over the past maybe 50 years. When I first joined the Getty Research Institute in 2011, I came in to a sort of new program that was called Digital Art History, and we were supporting the scholars program that was there that had scholars from all around the world who wanted to study at the Research Institute come and stay on campus, use the facilities, use the special collections to do their research. And we worked in tandem with them to help them understand that there were new technologies to allow them to do this kind of work so that they weren't trying to photocopy books and like package them to send them home. We literally had to say, look, there's this great button on the Xerox machine that will allow you to turn it into a PDF, and then you can just email it to yourself so you don't have to ship anything. I mean, that's where we were at in 2011. So the idea that these sort of bigger organizations could help us standardize how we create these systems and share them with scholars, with the general public, was really important. And we're just starting to get there now with 3D material. So I'm part of a group called Community Standards for 3D Preservation. We've had several forums on just this type of thing of how do we lend support to organizations moving forward, libraries, archives, to do this kind of work. And whether it's limiting what's going to be expected of them or creating partnerships with technical organizations that, or technical giants, I should say, that we know are invested in this in terms of their own legacy, the product, you know, their own product legacy. I think that's where we're seeing a lot of support come now. But it's also an, you know, a problem for global warming and the way that we think about energy. And I think that whole conversation is going to be shifting over the next couple of decades. I don't know that our digital infrastructures are going to be able to support the exponential curve of our data output. And at some point, there are going to have to be things that shift, and we're going to have to think of new ways of just dealing with the energy output from all of this technology. So that's a very long-winded way of answering your question, but I see these things as so interconnected that I think you can't have one conversation without talking about the other things.
Right. Now, I think that you're absolutely spot on. And for the people who are listening who are not, you know, super savvy about infrastructure and all that kind of stuff, let me decode a couple of things for you. So first of all, when somebody says that something is stored in the cloud, right? I've actually met a lot of people who think that that means that the information is somehow completely ephemeral. It's in the atmosphere around us and it is plucked out of the sky through some, you know, technological mechanism that converts that, you know, static field or whatever it is into files. And that's just not what that means. When somebody says that something is stored in the cloud, it really just means that it's not stored at your office, your building, your house, wherever it is. It's stored somewhere else and you access it through a computer network. And a lot of computer networks, most computer networks are still physical networks. So if you think of fiber connections to your house, if you connect through cable, even on these big hubs, like if I'm pulling information, if I have satellite internet at my house and I am pulling information that is stored physically on a server in Europe, that information first has to cross a entire Atlantic Ocean underneath of the ocean through a pipe that has, you know, fiber optic cables inside of it. So it's still at some point in the chain a physical connection, right? And, you know, that physical connection means two things. That means there's an actual physical location of this data and that the energy used to keep that physical machine working is the same as me having my computer plugged in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but at an enormous scale. So when, you know, you were talking about this, when Francesca is talking about, you know, the environmental impact, and this also touches on things like cryptocurrency mining and just the entire information infrastructure of the world, you know, it's all about power and how do we get it? How do we make it cleaner? Because the needs keep growing and the power consumption keeps growing. And, you know, it's about creating efficiencies and, you know, both in the way that power is generated, power is moved, but also efficiencies in terms of the amount of power that's used by any, you know, computing infrastructure and framework. So I hope that that, you know, helps people out there who might not be like super entrenched in this all the time. The other thing that scares me about that, though, is that because all of this information is shared, is physical, right? Now we have to actually start thinking about if we have all of these museums and academic institutions and cultural institutions that are starting to store all of these records digitally, and let's say that they're all contracted with Amazon Web Services as their hosting provider, right? That's where the archive is going to live. That means that that data physically lives at Amazon somewhere, at some Amazon facility. And even though there may be backups and redundancies, those might still be within the same physical facility. So if a natural disaster happens at that particular facility, depending on the level of redundancy and whatever else, you could literally have a Library of Alexandria situation where all of this information from all these institutions vanishes because the place where it was stored is physically destroyed. What do you think about that? That centralization of data with, you know, companies like Amazon and Google and places like that versus decentralizing this data. Have you thought about, you know, that infrastructure redundancy issue?
Yeah. And I've talked about it a number of times with some of my librarian friends. And I think the libraries are still not quite at the point where they're understanding decentralized computing and how it might be able to serve them moving forward. I think they're still really invested in, you know, them being the sort of central hub and repository for this information. While they make use of maybe some services, they do try to build out their own home servers and have their own data repositories for all this kind of information. But the truth of the matter is, as things sort of continue to exponentially grow, these data infrastructures aren't immaterial. They are material. There is a virtual thingness to them. And that physical materiality that goes along with their existence is just as vulnerable as a museum would be in itself. So like you were talking about the museum in New York, there was a very famous fire not that long ago that destroyed a large part of the collection of the National Museum of Brazil. And it was horrific. But one of the things that Google had done was documented the space with their 360 Matterport style capture. And so they were able to preserve and sort of bring back, resurrect that space virtually for the museum so that people can have a facsimile of it, a digital facsimile of it still. And so there's some ways that these technologies can help support us in resurrecting things that may have been lost, but they themselves are vulnerable to being lost over time. And we're seeing a lot of digital projects, digital humanities projects, for example, digital scholarship, that just at some point get sunset. Like different departments can only support so much for so long. And once those faculty members are no longer affiliated with a department, the expectation that we'll continue to hold on to their files for them just isn't reasonable. So, for example, we were contacted by a retired faculty member who said, oh, I was working on a project from 25 years ago with a graduate student, and here were the file names that were used back then. Do you still have that data, that statistical data that I had on your network back then, that your intranet back then? And the answer was, no, we don't. We don't have access to that. If it's not an active project, it's something that eventually gets sunset. And sunset is a term that we use in sort of these information technology spheres that just means when a project is sunset, it's we retire it and we can't continue to support it. So in some cases, if it's been documented by the Internet Archive, that we'll use the Wayback Machine as a way to sort of still allow access to something that once was on the web. But for the most part, digital things do die. And I think that's one thing that we don't recognize quite enough, is that in the same way that, you know, certain material is hard to preserve, things like fabric, right, is really, really difficult to preserve. And so we can only take care of it or take it out of the case in certain ways, or we have to be really delicate with the way that we preserve it, and sometimes have to admit that we can't preserve it. The same goes for, I think, our digital data. There's some cases that we are just going to have to admit defeat and see if we can't preserve it in other forms. So that's why when I work with faculty members, we often talk about, okay, so you've developed a interactive website for your project, an interactive publication. Why don't we do a screen capture of you interacting with the project and, you know, record however long we need to, so that every aspect of the project is touched and we have a screen recording of that. And that's a video file. That's something that's a little more stable for long-term preservation. And so if we do have to sunset the project eventually and we can't support the data structure, the content management system, it's no longer in fashion or it's proprietary. So for example, Google will routinely sort of create products, be used by a lot of academics, and then they go away because they stop supporting them. So when that happens, if we have at least a video capture of someone using the tool, then we have an example of what it once was. And so those are the ways that we're still sort of strategizing around getting around these issues, which aren't at all perfect, but they're a good way to still collect information around what was created digitally.
In its own way, it's a little bit theatrical, isn't it? Right. So, you know, in the sense that when you do a theater performance, you know, each performance is, you know, not captured, you know, all the time. I mean, most of them aren't, right? If you're very lucky and you know, do something that is considered to be important either to the theater, the community, or the, you know, the school or wherever you're performing it. You know, people will come out and they'll video, you know, your performance. But for the most part, like if you're doing a regional, like local theater production, that's there and it's gone. But the root, the data, right? The script that you were working from and any like little behind the scenes photos, or if you had a photographer come out to get like promotional shots, like those are the things that exist from it. And it's kind of funny to apply that to the interactive world, which we just have this idea persists, but it's so, so quick for things to just vanish. And I really, really mean that. I mean, if we even look back at like video games, you know, I think Internet Archive started doing like a video game collection, right? Of old, you know, DOS games and stuff like that. And as soon as the support for those processors, as soon as the support for whatever goes, I mean, you know, unless you're hooked into a project like that, you know, that video game is gone, right? You need to have access to the hardware. You need to have access to, well, a functioning version of the hardware. You need to sometimes have access to a regional emulator on the hardware. Like there's so many barriers to entry to go back in time to look at video games that were even just 20 years old, let alone 30 or 40. So I think that people kind of need to get it in their head. There's like this popular idea that like, if it's on the internet, it never dies. It's like, well, maybe that works for an idea, like a notoriety, right? Like if somebody says something really stupid and they become very public as a figure, then, you know, that reputation might follow them for a long time, but the actual thing can just go away very, very quickly. Platforms come and go in a cycle of, you know, 5 to 10 years, even popular ones. Like something like Facebook is incredibly weird that it's survived as long as it has and that people still use it as much as they do. That's a really like the farthest outlier of platforms that I can even imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, it's true for objects as well that are technology objects. There was a really interesting documentary made around Aibo digital dogs. I don't know if you've...
I haven't seen the documentary, but I remember Aibo, yeah.
Well, they were really popular, particularly in Japan. And the documentary explores how the company at some point stopped supporting one of the versions of the dog, a really popular version. And people were like black marketing, trying to get the sort of different pieces that they needed to replace parts of the dog to keep them working. And they were actually having sort of Aibo dog funerals because these things weren't supported anymore because the technologies, the component parts were no longer being made and the company wasn't, you know, putting them out anymore. So it's the same thing for a lot of these software products. And I think we'll see a number of niche museums. There are different organizations around the preservation of the internet and certain kinds of technologies connected to the internet that are doing this kind of work to collect all the hardware and the software and try to think about how do you migrate those things forward or at least maintain sort of a couple of different versions of that hardware so that if something breaks, you can replace it and keep it moving forward. But ultimately, it's the same way, you know, when we look at old stereoscopes, right? The ones that have survived are the ones that we have, and those are the ones that we can use. So it goes the same way in the digital world. And I think some people forget about the materiality of the digital world, but it really is, it's not so dissimilar.
I need to Google something to see if it exists because, you know, that whenever that's like my thing now, whenever an idea pops in my head, I'm like, I really hope somebody's done that. But the idea that popped in my head just now was preserving some of the earliest publicly made digital artwork. And those, I think, were like BBS intro graphics. You know, when you would log on with a BBS and, you know, through like terminal or whatever it was back in the late 80s, early 90s, there were a lot of people who made this ASCII artwork and it was really elaborate and everyone had their own sort of custom welcome screen. And you think about that and you're like, you know, that's kind of fascinating artistically, like culturally, right? Because that was a moment in time. Everybody was sort of using the same format, but all the artwork was unique and different and custom to each community that it represented. And I really hope that somebody has done a project where they've, you know, done at least like screenshots and tried to preserve some of these things. But I'm sure that there are like, you know, thousands upon thousands of these that have just been lost over time. So I think that's a, you know, maybe a good analogy for your stereoscope, you know?
Yeah, it's true. A lot of early digital, I say digital, I mean, internet culture, we don't have a great record. We didn't have people sort of thinking, oh, this is going to go out of style. It seemed so, you know, now, so of the time. And there are those of us in the preservation field that are trying to find as many images, as many people who were in those communities as possible to find ways of pulling that out and preserving it. Glitch Feminism is by Legacy Russell is one of my favorite pandemic reads. And she talks about just how a lot of different communities found connection through internet, sort of different either chat rooms or games, locations, essentially. And these are things that we need to document in the same way that we would document communities and their participation in the real world. And so it's just a little bit more difficult to track things down in the World Wide Web sometimes.
One thing that we're doing at this space that is it's a DAO, it's a distributed autonomous organization, and it's structured kind of like a co-op. And it's here in downtown Los Angeles, I'm a part of it. It's called Secker Factory. And we're really trying to turn this into a physical, digital experience space in a way that hasn't really been done before. There are a couple of galleries that are out there right now that are like NFT galleries and things like that. We don't really consider ourselves to be a gallery. We're more like a collaboration and presentation space for digital artists. And one thing that we're trying to do is we have like a digital twin of the gallery space in VR chat. And what we have done is we've made a portal where if you're in the VR chat, you can see a video stream of the extension, sort of the mirror of the physical space. And we're also projecting a camera position from that digital space in the physical space on one wall. So it's almost like you can walk right up to this weird, you know, kind of like Alice in Wonderland mirror and see the VR chat version and the people that are interacting there and kind of like, you know, literally peer from one universe into the other. And I'm working to build a couple of other extensions to that. Like we want to create something that's similar to New York's Storm King Center, where it's just a large, expansive, you know, digital sculpture area for large scale digital works. So if you present that in VR, let's say that I create a 3D model that is intended to be experienced at the same scale as, you know, like a large public work, like 3-4 stories tall. Seeing that on a screen doesn't really convey the intent as an artist. So in this space, what I'm trying to do is create a place where you can go virtually and experience the object at the scale in which the artist intended. And, you know, really trying to figure out ways to better contextualize the intent of all of us as creators. I also see what we're doing there as like completely ephemeral. It's almost like I don't know how any of this is going to be preserved. The experience is definitely not going to be retained when you move it to either another digital or physical space. And part of me is bothered by that because it's like, it's very unique and it's very sensory oriented. But I don't know if it even matters if we have a record of that that's more robust than flat images and a couple of 3D scans. But I mean, there are just some things that I don't think we're ever going to be able to capture, you know?
I agree. One of the reasons why I got into 360 technology back in 2015 was because I was really interested in trying to capture the context as well as the work of art. So if it's a performance, right, the audience as well as the performance that's happening. If it's happening in a particular space, so if you're thinking about Trisha Brown's work, or Brené Brown has did a number of site-specific performances. And when I was working with him, he was performing within an exhibition space at the Fowler and the Fowler Museum at UCLA. And the importance of how their work, their sort of performance work happened within the space, within everything that was in the space, and the way that the audience was positioned in that gallery space. All of that matters in terms of our understanding of the work. And so as someone who is a scholar and researched exhibitions, I always wanted to know more about the places that were exhibiting the work and how the work worked in relationship to one another. That was so essential to me. And a few photographs gave me a feeling of, okay, I can see the sort of some of the design that was brought into place. I can see how some of these works were working in relationship to one another, but I never got the whole sort of the same experience of walking through the gallery. And now with some of these technologies, we can, and 360 was something that it's since it's a video and image export or file system, that seemed more stable for long-term preservation than some of the 3D recreation technology that I was seeing. I work really closely with a colleague who's been building a reconstruction, a historical reconstruction of the Chicago's World's Fair. And that painstakingly detailed work that she's been doing exists in a virtual environment that she has to keep migrating forward as the technology changes. And every single time, it's, you know, her stomach is in knots as to whether or not it will be migrated forward, whether she can continue to bring that sort of recreation that she's done into the next version. But the beauty of that is that when you can inhabit that space, you actually start to understand you could never walk the Chicago's World's Fair in a week. You know, like it was so big. These buildings were so massive. The amount of people that were there, you can't even begin to understand until you can place yourself within that virtual environment. And so I think for artists who are using environment as an essential part of the work, it's so important that we capture that context and migrate it forward to those who are studying it in the future, because you can't fully understand the impact of something per se if you can't envision how big or small or far or near something was. So I think it's incredibly important, and I hope we continue to find ways to bring that kind of contextual information into the archive, despite, you know, all the difficulties involved. I do think it's essential for our understanding, and it gives a different kind of understanding than what we have from just, you know, photographs and writing. And I think we tend to fall back on writing in academia as a way of preserving information. And as someone who is not a primary textual learner, I'm more of a visual learner or auditory learner, I find that that's a detriment to our future understanding of things. And so it's something we know really well. The book has been around for a really long time. We've learned as a society how to do that well. But I hope now that we understand with work around, whether it's divergent minds, neurodivergence, and understanding that people relate to the world so differently and learn differently, that it's important to also think of the other parts of the human sensorium that are important to our understandings of the world and how, and then relate that to how we preserve the world.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, when we start talking about, you know, availability of information or archiving of information, we come to this other place where, I don't know if you've read anything about like the contextual collapse that we're experiencing on the internet right now, where younger people are discovering bands from like 40 years ago or films from 40 years ago. One is like Rocky Horror Picture Show as an example that I always use, where they are discovering these things and then sort of judging them by the standards at which we currently express ourselves in society, and kind of throwing things that used to be progressive into this bucket of either, you know, racist or problematic. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing in terms of like just where we are in society, but I think it's a bad thing in terms of understanding the context in which the culture and in which some of these artifacts were created, right? So if you, again, look at Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, even though the character of Dr. Frankenfurter was played by Tim Curry, who is a cisgender heterosexual man, you know, the piece was written by a person who, you know, Richard O'Brien, he definitely considers himself queer. I don't know what, you know, other descriptors he would apply to himself, but he, you know, cross dresses and, you know, has a, you know, very fluid sense of gender identity, but it's made like in the 70s, right? And that's a time and place where this was a radical, even though it's not like a, even though they're not casting people who are transgender and things, and they're using words like transvestite and transsexual, which were, you know, academic clinical terms at the time, right? You know, you look at that, or accepted terms, and you look at that and you go, oh, wow, this is so problematic. That's such a bad word. They didn't cast people who were doing this. It's like, yeah, but in the cultural context of when this came out, this was an incredibly like radically progressive piece of media. So how do we, if at all, you know, preserve cultural context around cultural experiences and artifacts so that future generations, as we're seeing now, can better understand where things sort of fell in terms of how, what they're expressing? Like, we, because those ideas that were being expressed in something like Rocky Horror are not meant to be hurtful ideas. They're meant to be empowering ideas. They just don't look that way because of our current understanding. So it's like, you know, we've got to figure out some way to educate people, you know, about everything that they're experiencing all at once, because all media is now available all the time to everyone.
It's so true. It's one of the things that I wrestle with my in teaching my students about how to approach digital humanities. One of the things that we talk about is a chapter by Michelle Rolfe Chouillot, who's a Haitian professor of anthropology and social sciences, who unfortunately has passed away relatively early, but he wrote a book called The Power in the Story, Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History. And I tend to start my class there because he talks about sort of positivist and constructivist versions of history and why those approaches don't ultimately do us justice. And so his recommendation is to look for the power context, look for the, like, who's speaking and why and what their goals are and what were their goals at the time, right? So try to find as much context around the situation as you possibly can, because when we think about positivist approaches, which is essentially the sort of objectivist, distant observer of facts, you know, strictly facts, just tell me the who, what, where, when, and why of the situation, and therefore we will have history, right? That ultimately we know to not be reliable because history is told by the victors. So constructivist approaches look at the way that we interpret things. So understanding that there's, we choose a beginning, we choose a middle, we choose an end, we choose the ways that the different points within the story, the high points, the low points, and that's a perspective that's lent is a really important approach. But that even in understanding that these things are sort of pieced together over time, that doesn't quite give us the full picture. And so Trouillot is sharing that it always comes down to sort of the power dynamics that are connected to a situation and finding the greater context. So when I try to teach students about different artifacts, you know, if we talk about museum objects, I often refer to Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett's writing around the ethnographic fragment. So all of these things, when we pluck them out of their original context and we place them in a museum, they suddenly mean something else. They take on a whole new life. There's a whole new context that surrounds them because of that displacement. And the same thing goes for the internet, right? When we pluck something and put it on the internet, it's suddenly outside of its original cultural context. And yes, we should be responsive to it. We always bring our own perspectives and reactions when we see something in a museum or when we see it online. We bring our own lenses to that, and we should be critical. But we also have to think about the context that was of the time, how it was understood then, and try to knit those things together as much as we can. And that takes work. And I think the thing that I'm trying to always encourage people to do is the critical thinking around, you know, those gut reactions that we have to things and why we might have them, and then finding a way to knit those things together so that we can come to a fuller understanding.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten into plenty of heated discussions with some of my friends, especially in like film criticism and things of that nature, where they come from a very objectivist point of view. They really try to, you know, divorce the art from the artist. And I can understand that in a way that like might serve them for, you know, contemporary criticism of something that's in the publicity cycle, right? Like looking at a film that's going to be coming out and making, you know, a critical determination about it. It's a little bit of a different animal than, you know, looking at something in a historical context, right? But ultimately, I think in a historical context, when you start to divorce the art from the artist or the object from the culture, you know, however they, whatever dynamic there is that you can create an analogy from, you're losing most of the importance of even, you know, putting that object into a place of contemplation, like a museum or, you know, some other, you know, institution, academic setting, whatever it is. So, you know, I found that, did you go to see the Miyazaki exhibit here at the Motion Picture Academy Museum?
I'm seeing it tomorrow.
You're seeing it tomorrow. So I'll
give me a preview now.
Spoiler alert. There's two things. First, you know, it's a little bit shallow. You know, it's just kind of more of an attraction than a, you know, deep dive into some of this stuff. It has a lot of his like, you know, sketches and papers and things, but it, you know, it's very impersonal. It's all about the work, and it's all just kind of like whatever seems to have been laying around the studio when they went and they grabbed things and put them on display. So you'll get like storyboards and stuff like that. And I don't expect, you know, a huge deep dive into, you know, the research of Miyazaki as a person and as an artist in a situation like that. But one thing that I do love is that it really uses multimedia in a fascinating way. So when you start to enter the environment, they've, you know, kind of painted things to look like a Miyazaki, you know, background, like a foresty kind of a setting. They do like very simple little set design things that are kind of nice little like sensual triggers. And then you enter to this spherical room or cylindrical room where they're showing like looping clips of his films on different walls. And, you know, that is kind of interesting because it shows you a little bit of the final product, right? So then as you go around into the other room, you start to see the storyboards, you start to see some of these other objects that influenced objects in the film. And they're all a little bit disassociated from each other. You have to draw your own conclusions. They don't really have a lot of plaques for you to read and stuff like that, which I think probably the museum could have been a little bit better about, you know, creating those connections between the objects. But I like the idea that it's just saturating you with context and connection. It's not just showing you, you know, like a storyboard from Miyazaki and then, you know, letting you contemplate it. It's showing you a storyboard It's showing you this final product. It's showing you a sculpture that this object was based on from, you know, Japanese mythology or whatever it is. It's showing you some behind the scenes photographs of, you know, what Miyazaki looked like when he was doing it. And I think that that's a really, really good step in the right direction for building not just exhibits like this, but interactive, you know, sort of contextual archival arrangements. And that, they can be on websites, they can be in virtual spaces, they can be in books, they can be whatever, but it's a great kind of arrangement showing those relationships.
Absolutely. Showing process also is one of my favorite things in terms of understanding dynamic and a topic. If you can show me the processes that were associated with it, I just remember it so much more clearly. And I think one of the reasons is that if you think of the old adage, we remember 10% of what we hear, what we read, 20% of what we hear, and 80 to 90% of what we experience. And exhibitions are a environment in which it's about the experience. So how do we bring ourselves to play on that when we're creating exhibitions? How do we bring that out? And I think focusing on process is a key way of doing that.
Absolutely. And one thing that is going to be really difficult, I think, in the next century for archivists and academics to wrestle with is how do you start to contextualize work that is procedurally generated? Because there is currently a boom through tools like Midjourney and Disco Diffusion and Deep Dream of all of these artworks that are created through text prompt and an AI neural net coming up with these images and videos. And, you know, I don't even know how to start to approach creating context around that. I mean, how would you, have you given a thought to that?
Well, there's a couple of different exhibitions rattling around in my head and exhibition ideas. And one of the things that I think is a phenomenon we're seeing today, at least because of things like YouTube, is we have so many do-it-yourself or how-to videos out there. And it's, at least in terms of artistic production, I think it's really changed how we might understand artistic practice, right? There wasn't how-to videos when Michelangelo was doing his work or Da Vinci, right? We have their scraps of papers, and that's the way that we've talked about their process in the past. And there's been exhibitions that will, you know, share sort of, this is how paint was made. This is how lapis lazuli was ground down in order to, and combined with different kinds of oils in order to create different paints and that sort of thing, which has always been really fascinating to me in terms of an exhibition tactic. But I think it would be really interesting to see curators try to bring out process by actually looking at these DIY or, you know, a lot of artists now make a living from sharing their practice online, sharing time-lapsed videos of them working in their studio or Patreon style sort of gallery discussions around their work and their practice and what they're doing and their techniques. And I think that that's something that could be brought into an exhibition space to help people understand the work from that point of process.
I think there's something to also connect it back as this weird middle ground between conceptual work and visual art, right? Where in this case of a text prompt generated piece of artwork, you end up with the artist sort of driving the intellectual process. You end up with the AI creating the visual component for it. And if we look at, you know, like, you know, Dadaism and sort of the lineage that branches off from that, you can start to maybe figure out ways to exhibit work so that the meaning is derived from intent, right? instead of necessarily completely about process. And, you know, that's a whole other artistic world debate, right? It always seems to be out there. It's like, is it art if it's, you know, just an intellectual, you know, concept that's being put forward into a medium, or is it only, you know, art if it is, you know, that combined with physical craftsmanship? And, you know, that debate always seems to like rear its head every couple of years. I fall in the first category, but I don't know. It's going to be an interesting time now that the tools are becoming so much more exotic, I guess, in terms of what they're able to produce. So with that all said, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate you coming on and you know, sharing your time and your knowledge. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Sure. You can visit my website at bit.ly/Albrezzi, Albrezzi. That's a great way to find me. I also have a podcast that I occasionally do. I've fallen behind, but it's called Albrezzi Office Hours. I hope to get more episodes out soon, so you can catch me there. And I'm also on Instagram at Francesca Albrezzi, PhD, so you can find me there as well.
Well, thank you again, Francesca. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you to all of our listeners, and especially our patrons. If you're not currently a supporter, visit phantomastronaut.com to find out all the different ways that you can help us continue making the show. And I will see you out there.